We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
The forecast for East Central Illinois this afternoon, mostly sunny, hot, and humid. We'll see a high in the low to mid-90s. The wind from the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low of 70. The wind out of the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with a high of 95 and a southwest wind from 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly clear, the low 72, the wind from the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Friday, mostly sunny, look for a high in the mid-90s. The wind will be from the southwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Friday night, partly cloudy with a low in the low 70s. Saturday and Saturday night, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. We'll see a high Saturday in the upper 80s and a low Saturday night in the mid-60s. The outlook for Sunday, partly sunny and cooler. Expect a high in the low 80s. At noon Central Time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana were in the upper 70s to the low 90s. Most locations reporting sunny skies. Rockford reported 77 degrees at the top of the hour. It was 79 at O'Hare. In Bloomington, 86 in Mattoon, 88 in Carbondale, 90. South Bend, 81. Lafayette, 85. It was 82 at Indianapolis. And Terre Haute reported 85 degrees at the top of the hour. Willard Airport had a temperature of 87 degrees, a sunny sky. The dew point, 63. The relative humidity, 44%. The wind out of the south at 8. The barometric pressure, 29.99 and falling. And at 12:39, 90 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. The year 2010 was a very bad one for Haiti. It started with an earthquake that killed over 300,000 people, mostly in the crowded capital of Port-au-Prince. After that, cholera, originating in a UN camp, broke out in a northern province and eventually spread to the city. But public health researchers learned something useful from the tragedy. Cell phones can help stem an unfolding epidemic and funnel aid to the needy. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
The 1-2 punch of earthquake and cholera threatened to decimate the crowded capital city of Port-au-Prince. The quake drove a million survivors into tent camps with little sanitation or clean water. Months later, cholera emerged in a northern province and threatened to invade the city. So authorities sent radio and television celebrities into the camps, like this one on a highway median strip. The visitors led children in song. The message?
Epidemie, maladie, choléra.
An epidemic of cholera threatened. The song said, wash your hands, drink clean water, report diarrhea. But while celebrities sang, international organizations were doing something rather different, tracking people in and out of the city and across the northern provinces where cholera was spreading. They did it by tracking calls back to the SIM cards in people's cell phones. Linus Bengtsson, a public health expert at Sweden's Karolinska Institute, says the tracking started before the epidemic, just after the earthquake.
When people start to move around, as they often do after a disaster, it's very difficult to know where to deliver supplies.
Watching the tragedy unfold from Sweden, Bengtsson knew that cell phone companies, like Digicel in Haiti, keep data on calls for billing purposes. And he knew the company could trace each call in their records to the closest cell tower, sometimes within a couple of blocks of the phone. Bengtsson reached out to public health specialist Richard Garfield of Columbia University. At the time, Garfield had been working at Haiti's National Hospital.
So I went over and knocked on the door at Digicel.
What did they say?
They were quite receptive conceptually to the idea.
The idea being, follow quake refugees to find out where people are in need. The team followed almost 2 million phones before and after the quake. They found that within 3 weeks, more than 600,000 people fled Port-au-Prince, and they knew where they went. Health officials were somewhat relieved at the news. It took pressure off aid groups inside the capital, but the relief didn't last long. The cell phones showed the refugees didn't stay in the countryside.
They're already producing all the food they can in those depleted lands, and there was just a very temporary capacity to hold those people. So people kept moving around, which often occurs in mass disasters, and quickly came back to Port-au-Prince as soon as they could.
Then cholera struck in northern Haiti, so the Karolinska team tracked cell phone owners there, people who fled the epidemic area. Where they went, the disease could follow. Authorities needed to know where to send medical aid, and it worked.
The second wave of cases did appear exactly in the areas where most of the population were moving to, who were moving out of the cholera zone.
The team never knew the names of phone owners, but health authorities could still send the phone owners health advice via voicemail and text. Sabina Carlson from the International Organization for Migration recites one of the messages that went out.
Continue by ti bébé yo tété comme à toi même si yogen diarrhée, so which is continue to breastfeed young children even if they have diarrhea.
Scientists who track disease, like malaria expert Andrew Tatum of the University of Florida, say the technique has great promise.
I think it's incredibly beneficial. I think we're kind of seeing a glimpse of the future of gathering information for disaster management.
The results of the project appear in the journal PLOS Medicine. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Many of the places in Hurricane Irene's path were big tourist destinations. North Carolina's Outer Banks, Cape Cod, Ocean City, Maryland. Some businesses in those areas escaped relatively unscathed, allowing managers to breathe a sigh of relief and hope for a big turnout over the Labor Day weekend. Others weren't so lucky. Places like Sally T's Grill. It's located just blocks from the ocean in Monmouth Beach, New Jersey. It's a big operation that serves everything from jumbo sea scallops to deli fare to sushi. Nick Covell is the chef and general manager of Sally T's. He told NPR's David Green that he stayed at the restaurant until Saturday afternoon when coastal residents were ordered to leave.
We have a lot of locals. I'm sure we could have had a lot of people here for a little bit, but it was a mandatory evacuation, so we had to close.
Do you remember a storm that's done this much damage?
Well, I've been here for almost 12 years, and I have never had water come in like this. No, I've never seen anything like this. This is the most devastating that I've ever seen. You know, I think everything kind of played together, kind of like the perfect storm. We had a new moon, we had a high tide, and we had a storm surge at the same time. So this place was virtually underwater.
We got Nick Covell on the phone from the restaurant as he was beginning the long process of making repairs after the storm.
It's a disaster in here, you know. I mean, as you can hear in the background, I have people ripping carpets up right now. We're trying to get items cleaned, and everything's a loss in terms of food and everything. You know, the quality we serve here, anything that is even a thought has to go. You know, there's nothing. We have to clean out.
And as best you can, I know that sound in the background you said is people pulling up your carpeting. To describe the scene that you're looking at.
I'm looking at a group of men that are tearing up carpet that we just did renovations a few months ago.
Hmm.
I'm looking at a scene that's making me sick right now. I'm looking at the saturated carpets being ripped up. And, you know, it's just musty, nasty right now. And it has to be taken care of step at a time. We won't do anything other than doing it the right way, because that's how we always do it at Sally T's.
Give me a sense, if you can, how much business do you think you're losing each day, each week that'll go by?
Well, if we're closed for a couple weeks, including this, it could be somewhere in a couple $100,000 for a 2 to 3 week period, easy.
And how many workers do you have?
Around 60.
And will they all be without their paychecks for a little while?
Some people who will be utilized in a restaurant, there's some people who are going to just have to collect unemployment. You know, I feel horrible because we have wonderful people that work in this place, and all I'm trying to do is get a handle on everything so I know how to handle them as well as possible, because they deserve nothing but to be treated great.
And Nick, how important is Labor Day weekend to the business usually?
It's a huge weekend. You know, it's our last hurrah. We're a seasonal place. We're not as seasonal as a lot of restaurants in the area. We continue to do a vibrant business all year long. However, Labor Day weekend is a very, very busy weekend for us.
And what are you telling your customers? I mean, I'm sure some of them might be wondering if Sally T's is going to come back if you might have to close.
Right now, all I'm telling them is thank you for your patronage, and we're going to try to get open as quick as possible, because when we're closed, it's a big thing to the people around here, because they love coming here. The owner, Joe Emile, made a statement that, you know, could be a protracted closing. There's things that we have to do so that we can get this place back to the level that we demand before we serve people.
Nick Cavell is the chef and general manager of Sally T's Grill in Monmouth Beach, New Jersey. He spoke with NPR's David Green. One of the nation's largest gas companies, Pacific Gas and Electric, is to blame for an explosion in California's Bay Area last year. That's the unanimous finding of the National Transportation Safety Board. The blast killed 8 people and destroyed 38 homes. Amy Standen of member station KQED has more.
On September 9, 2010, a high-pressure gas pipeline ruptured under a suburban neighborhood about 10 miles south of San Francisco. Tammy Zapata was at home making dinner. Like many residents, she thought an airplane had crashed nearby.
When I looked up this way, see how all those big trees are like that? No matter how high up you looked, all you saw was fire.
On Tuesday, the NTSB released its final report on a year-long investigation into what went wrong that evening. Investigators placed blame squarely on the utility, which owns the pipeline. NTSB Chairman Deborah Hersman cited what she called a litany of failures,
including poor record-keeping, inadequate inspection programs, and integrity management programs without integrity.
PG&E has been unable to produce even basic records about the 30-inch pipe that ruptured or who made it. NTSB's Hersman ended her presentation of the report with a call for tighter regulation and a quote from Ronald Reagan.
Trust, but verify. And where trust is not merited, make sure that the penalty is high.
More than 100 former residents affected by the blast have filed civil lawsuits against PG&E. They're seeking compensation for lives and property lost. The first batch of those cases is expected to make it to court next summer. The company may also face criminal charges. For NPR News, I'm Amy Standen in San Francisco.
This month, maintenance work is being performed on our AM580 antenna. It'll make our signal more reliable, especially during inclement weather. At times when the work is in progress, we'll need to reduce our power, and some of you may have trouble receiving AM 580 as clearly as usual. 90.9 FM will not be affected, and AM 580 is always available online at will.illinois.edu. Thanks for understanding.
Here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 31st of August, 2011. It's the anniversary of the death of the novelist and poet and automatic writer Elsa Barker in 1954, best known for her trilogy Letters from a Living Dead Man, a book of the occult which she said had been dictated to her by a man named X, whom she never saw and never met. It's the 64th birthday of manga artist Yumiko Oshima, born 1947 in the Tochigi Prefecture of Japan, a member of the Year 24 Flower Group, a group of women who have revolutionized shoujo manga, comic books for girls, bringing to these comic books issues of philosophy.